And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and it's my pleasure to welcome back Preston Lauterbach to the program today. Preston was last on to talk about his debut, The Chitlin' Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll. Today we'll be discussing his newest nonfiction title, Bill Street Dynasty, Sex, Song, and the Struggle for the Soul of Memphis, which is published by W.W. Norton. Preston, in 2013, USA Today named Beale Street the best iconic street in America, beating out the Strip in Vegas, Bourbon Street down in New Orleans. But the Beale Street of today is a very different street from its historical past, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it was not founded as a tourist destination, but the story that I tell in the book is about its previous life as the main street of Black America. So it goes into how that particular identity was developed, what that meant, and this main street of Black America's contributions to the world.
Now, in your research, did you find out when Beale Street first appeared on a map?
1841, still during the days of slavery. However, the earliest African-American property owner in Memphis purchased a lot on Beale Street in the 1850s. And so that's really where, I believe, the legacy began. And then throughout the war years and immediately after the war years, you had institutions like the First Baptist Church of Beale Street, the largest African-American congregation in West Tennessee, grow on Beale Street. The Freedmen's Bureau, you know, which was a key outlet for aid to the recently freed slaves after the Civil War, was also located on Beale Street. So pretty early on in its history, it did develop an identity and a strong affiliation with the African-American population.
Pretty much the story begins with Robert Church Sr.
Yes.
And he was a slave at the time of the war, and he was owned by his own father.
Yes. Their relationship, it's hard to understand, I think, by 21st century standards. The father owned the son, but also provided him an education, provided him with work, and provided him with a certain strength of character and an encouragement that I believe was absolutely critical in the civilization that Robert Church would form. And really, I mean, look, having a white father and an African-American or enslaved mother was not a completely unusual situation during those times. I think that the circumstance of father and son having a close relationship in which the father openly acknowledged the son was a little bit more unusual. But it's partially what made Robert Church such a complex figure. I mean, that very basic duality. And I think that his racial identity, being mixed as it was and being conflicted naturally, had a lot to do with the history that unfolded throughout Church's life.
And if you look at the pictures in the book, in other parts of the country, he could have very easily passed for Caucasian.
Absolutely. And yet he did identify as African American throughout his life. Now, you know, some cynics would say that it was better to be the top African-American than a middling white man, and that very well may be the case, but he still very willingly placed himself on the firing line.
Of course, not a lot of opportunities are going to be available to African-Americans after the Civil War in order to make money and grow an empire. So a lot of the businesses he entered into were on the unsavory side.
Well, they were. And, you know, I should back up and foreground that in his education. His father was a steamboat captain, owned a steamboat line that operated packets between Memphis and New Orleans. And so Robert Church grew up on the river, and it was really an extraordinary upbringing. And there he learned to deal with rich white men. The men that rode the steamboats were plantation bosses, gamblers. They liked their whiskey. They liked their card games. They liked their women. And Robert Church understood this, you know, from the very beginning of his life. After the war, when he settled in Memphis, he developed on dry land what he learned on the river, and that was how to serve these particular thirsts. From a moral standpoint, it was a completely different universe than what we are accustomed to now. Legally, it was a very different time. Prostitution was essentially legal in Memphis, had been recognized as a very reliable source of revenue. So prostitution was licensed. If you wanted to open a brothel, you would simply apply to the city council. You would pay a fee. And from that point on, you would be in business, just like if you wanted to open a confectionery or a dry goods store or any other venture. Of course, it was a little bit more colorful, I think, than those more typical business ventures. But that is the way that Church got going. And again, I think that his duality is really key, because unlike other freed people, he had the prominent, wealthy, white father to help him out. And so Captain Church, who was Robert Church's father, introduced him to all the prominent Memphis leading men, people like John Overton, another riverboat captain, James Lee, Hugh Brinkley. These are all very prominent, recognized individuals in the city of Memphis's history. And they were Church's allies. It was partially because of these relationships that he was able, as an African-American man, to run brothels staffed largely by white women.
Even though this is about Beale Street, but it's almost Beale Street as a concept for black Memphians and the black world in America, most of the bordellos were actually a block over on Gayoso.
That's right. The boundaries of the dynasty expanded beyond Beale Street. And I think the key dynamic in this history was that relationship between these two parallel streets, Gayoso and Beale, one block parallel to one another. On Gayoso Street was this strip of very lucrative and notorious, well-known, well-visited brothels, the heart of the red light district. One block over on Beale Street, Church eventually developed a more, I would say, virtuous or complete civilization. So the white prostitution helped to finance beautiful amusement park and auditorium that he developed for recreation, the Solvent Savings Bank, the first black-owned bank in Memphis, several other, I would say, more virtuous ventures that uplifted African-American life in the city.
And it was strange how they referred to the bordellos as resorts.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Just a place to go and relax, right?
Reconstruction hadn't quite gotten hold in Memphis in 1866, when the very first race riots post-Civil War take place in Memphis.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting. Memphis was spared the worst of the war. It fell into Union hands during a naval conflict on the river. So there was no battle between infantry that ever scarred the city. It was settled on the river fairly early on. So the fate that came to places like Richmond and Atlanta, you know, which were bombarded and destroyed, never happened in Memphis. Its worst scars were to come after the war, when you had two opposing constituencies, the old secessionist element, very pro-Confederate element, and a newer element embodied in the Union fort at Fort Pickering, which became largely staffed by African-American soldiers. So you had armed Yankees on patrol, and you had a police force in Memphis that was largely pro-Confederate. And these two roaming and often drunken bands of armed individuals had quite a few scrapes in the Beale Street and in the Fort Pickering neighborhood right about a year after Appomattox. That eventually exploded into a three-day race riot late April and early May of 1866.
Can we really call it a race riot as opposed to white thugs marauding?
No, it was a completely one-sided affair, and I think that the casualties and the damage list bears that out. So 46 African-Americans were killed. Two white deaths were recorded. Those were at least possibly due to friendly fire, cases of mistaken identity. So look, you got this Union fort, right? This is a symbol of protection to all of the African-American citizens who are leaving slavery in the surrounding area that are coming to the city to start new lives. So they build their churches and they build their schools and they build their homes in the protective area of this fort. Well, all of that is what was destroyed during the riot. Churches were burned, schools were burned. I'm talking about African-American, you know, the new African-American community that was building around that time. So a high number of deaths, property destruction, rapes, burglaries, and I think most, well, maybe not most noteworthy, but most influential in Robert Church's life, he was targeted. He was a business owner who had brought suit against the state under the much despised Civil Rights Bill that ventured to guarantee certain constitutional liberties to the new freed people. So he was one of the first to use that Civil Rights Bill in a court of law to get some freedom, which was based on him wanting to buy some pool tables and have a pool hall. So it's not like he was out there picketing for desegregated schools or anything that would characterize the civil rights movement later. But hey, it was a start. So he had a target on his back because of this, because of his status as a leading black citizen. And when the riots came to his neighborhood, he had a saloon at the corner of 4th and Gayoso Streets. Policemen broke into the place. He had these big, you know, wooden barrels full of whiskey, had cigars. So they go in there and they attack Mr. Church. They drink all the whiskey, let the rest of it run out of the barrels, smoke up his cigars, take the money out of the cash register, shoot him in the head, and leave him for dead. And I think it's at that moment, those two forces, one, the new black community being destroyed, and two, this leadership figure being attacked in that way, that really led people to gravitate to Robert Church as a leader and to that Beale Street neighborhood, where you had things like the bank, the Freedmen's Bureau, a church. So it relocated that community to the Beale Street area.
And about, was it 10 years later, he was shot in the head again. So he was
again.
He survived two shots to the head.
He really did. I mean, good luck, a thick skull, poor marksmanship. All of these things must have convened to spare him. And in fact, there was another attempt on his life. A man brought a shotgun into Church's saloon and confronted him and pointed both barrels of it at him, pulled the trigger, and the thing completely backfired and peppered the would-be assassin with buckshot instead. So he had pretty good luck.
Song, the concept of music, is also in the subtitle of the book. And the first notable musician on Beale was not African-American. He was a Prussian, of all
That's
people.
That's right, yes. And not only that, but he was one who had a certain association with the Southern cause for independence. Professor Arnold, he was known as. But he had been part of the inauguration of President Jefferson Davis as the leader of the Confederacy. And in this ceremony, had transcribed what had at that point been a informally composed song called Dixie, with it being put to paper for the first time and being performed in this setting at the president of the Confederacy's inauguration. It became the Confederate national anthem, you know, what it's associated with today. An unlikely candidate, I think, to be the first musician on Beale Street. Professor Arnold eventually did have a role in instructing some of the early generations of African-American musicians on the street.
Of course, W.C. Handy is the man that really takes Beale Street to the world.
Right.
But he's not a Memphian. He came from Alabama, of all places.
Yeah, well, he had grown up in Alabama, really came from Mississippi. He had already led a peripatetic professional life as a band leader. So he was another character, I think, who's a real boundary hopper, because there's this division, probably to this day, with musicians between writing musicians, those who can read and write musical notes, and the unlettered musicians. Well, Handy was a writing musician, and he was very proud of that. You know, he led the John Philip Sousa-style marching bands and conducted orchestral-type music. So it was a very, you know, high-class emphasis on music. But at the same time, he loved these more folk types of musicians that populated the South, whether it be the guy playing slide guitar on the railroad platform late at night waiting for a train, or you know, the blind preacher out on the street corner, the barroom saloon pianist. Handy had a real appreciation for these kinds of artists. By being a crossover figure who had the ability to compose music and someone who appreciated these lesser strains that filled the air, he was able to do what's, you know, basically done today in sampling, to take pieces of saloon piano, snatches of lyrics heard out on the street, weave it together and compose it, put it on paper, and to publish it, to bring it a much wider audience. And that is what led to the explosion in popularity of blues music, is him coming to Beale Street, listening to all of these rich musical traditions that were going on here, putting them on paper and crossing it over essentially from Beale Street, the black world, to Main Street, the white world.
And it makes a lot of sense, because you mentioned that Antonin Dvorak, the Eastern European composer, said that black music would be the source of America's classical music going forward, because he did utilize a lot of folk melodies in his compositions as well.
Yeah, and if you listen to, you know, the few early Handy recordings that are available, it would not just jump in your ear as the blues. It's the opposite of the blues stereotype in almost every way. I mean, it is orchestral music, but you can hear that blues form and that blues style, and that's really what hooked people.
Now, Handy was conned out of the copyright for his first hit, but he learned that lesson pretty quick, didn't he?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And really, it's quite a twist, because I personally think that being conned out of the copyright for that hit was the best thing that could have possibly happened to him. Because in signing over the copyright to a more established music company, it gave the song, I think, a much wider exposure than Handy was able to give it on his own, just with the experience, the avenues to promotion that were open to him. He had yet to really figure out the music business. So yeah, he gave up the copyright, he lost control of the song, and it went on to make a lot of money, but there's really no guarantee that the same song would have had the same fate with him in control of it. So what happened was, he gave up the copyright. Somebody souped up the lyrics to it after they bought it from him, and they name-dropped him in the lyrics. The song was Memphis Blues, and the line in there said something to the effect of, there's this band that you just got to see down there. You know, the song's going on and on about the virtues of Memphis music circa 1910. So it name-dropped him and said, you got to go see the Handy Band down there. And that, I think, did more to get Handy established than just the Mr. Crump composition on its own probably would have.
And his biggest hit becomes the St. Louis Blues. And because of the importance of the river back in the day, it seemed like St. Louis and Memphis had a lot more of a relationship than they do now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think that's certainly the case. There were a lot of figures that were prominent or moved between those cities in the gambling and the underworld circles. One of them in particular was Fatty Grimes, who was a great gambler who came down and got himself killed on Beale Street in 1905. In fact, he was a more or less a hired gun. So he came to Memphis at the behest of a man named Jim Canaan, who ran a place called the Monarch. The building is still standing down there on Beale Street. It's the last of the classic saloons that's still there. And he was in competition with the gamblers at a saloon a couple doors down called Hammett Ashford's. And the Ashford guys, I don't know if they caught Fatty Grimes cheating or if they were tired of him beating them. They were tired of him flirting with their girlfriends, which was also in play at the time. But they lured him down to the saloon either to play a game or to see a girl. And he came over and they ambushed him. And they shot him. They shot him so many times at such close range that someone who saw him staggering out of Hammett Ashford's saloon saw flames rising from the back of his coat. So he didn't make it out of Memphis. He probably should have stayed in St. Louis. There was another figure by the name of, it was Ashford. Ashford himself, who was behind this assassination, was a political affiliate of one of Mr. Crump's opponents. And so when Mr. Crump won his first mayoral election, part of the spoils was that he got to get rid of Hammett Ashford, who had supported one of the opposition candidates. You see, all of the politics in that time, the main political organizers were the saloon bosses. Prohibition was coming, and if you ran a saloon, you wanted to make sure you could do as you pleased despite the law. The best way to ensure that was to organize some votes for a candidate. This is how W.C. Handy rose to prominence. His rise to prominence and that of Mr. Crump are totally intertwined, because when Crump was running for the mayor's office in 1909, one of his saloonocrats was a guy named Jim Mulcahy. And Mulcahy ran a place called the Blue Heaven, which sounded like a very colorful establishment where they had prize fights and cock fights and dancing contests for this one particular move called the Barrel House, which sounded like it involved a lot of rolling around on the floor. And Handy used to play this place, the Blue Heaven. So when Mulcahy was getting up his guns, you know, to support Crump in the election, he invited Handy to join the campaign. And Handy, either at Mulcahy's behest or on his own inspiration, wrote this campaign tune for Mr. Crump. And it was really funny. It was the classic Handy song formula of, you know, take the kind of song organization, the composition format that he heard the roustabout singing down on the river, and take a little snatch of saloon piano and some of the lyrics that he heard people improvising on the street, which were about all the things that Mr. Crump was going to get rid of if he became mayor, and quilted into a song. And that song was called Mr. Crump.
He don't allow no easy riders.
That's right. It went on and on about all these things that Mr. Crump supposedly didn't like, which in truth he loved all of. That was renamed as the Memphis Blues. And it's got kind of a funny legacy because Crump did not win the Beale Street vote. The song initially went nowhere, and it was a pretty inauspicious beginning for what was really to come.
And, of course, one of America's greatest African-American composers lived in Memphis for a while, William Grant Still.
Absolutely, yeah. And he drank from the same waters that Handy did.
In the 1890s, there was a terrible incident surrounding the People's Grocery, a grocery store owned by a consortium of black men, and it really put a pall on the city.
One of the things that fascinated me in researching the story and in writing the book was just how exceptional Memphis was. And I came to see two golden eras, or eras of alternate universe, depending on how you want to look at it, where everywhere else in the South is oppression, violence, denial of rights. Those things pertain to black citizens. Whereas in Memphis, in the 1880s, and then later in the 1920s, there was a real unusual level of black political power, and I think a sense of opportunity that was very unusual. One of the key figures who's associated with that period in the 1880s and the unusual amount of liberty and opportunity here for black Memphians was Ida B. Wells. So not only was she female, she's African-American, two categories of humans that were really not encouraged to express themselves during this time period. But in Memphis, she found a very fertile print culture, newspapers, and she got into journalism. And she said, it was through journalism that I found the real me. She went on to become a great crusader, the cause of anti-lynching being foremost, I think, one of the founding figures associated with the NAACP. But she really spent her formative years in Memphis in this unusual environment. And she was really very much caught up in the end of that great golden era of progress that culminated with the lynching stemming from the People's Grocery.
And it's ironic that that led, what is it, 6,000 Memphians, African-American Memphians, to flee and go west. And many of them ended up in Kansas and Oklahoma, and only 30 years later to have the huge race riot in Tulsa, Oklahoma, take some of their lives.
Exactly. There was one figure in particular who had been a policeman on the Beale Street beat who left around the time of the lynching. I'm not exactly sure if he left after or just before, because things were kind of heating up. But where did he end up? Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he was there to witness the riot that took place there in 1921?
Yeah, 21. Yeah.
Okay.
Because Beale Street was known as the main street for black America, and Greenwood in Tulsa was known as the Wall Street for black America.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's a good book about that, and I heard that that Wall Street of black America tag, read in this book anyway, I didn't hear it, that was rather carelessly tacked on by a person who was interested in reviving the history of the riot. And it was a bit of an over-enthusiastic pronouncement, in the words of a more objective historian.
Kind of like the view of Robert Church's bond buying for...
Or of Church as the first black millionaire. You know, there aren't real precise statistics that back that up. But I mean, you know, the legendary status and the public relations that are involved with those kinds of titles are still significant, even if we don't know if they're 100% true.
And so your book spans from the Civil War to about 1940. And it just seems it's the cycle of advance and losing all those advances, and then advancing again and losing those advances again.
Yeah. Like I said, you had a very ambitious, I think very progressive black population here. And the other side of that is you had a white population that was really in flux with its attitudes towards this. So I talk about the two golden eras, or the eras of alternate universe, first one being in the 1880s. Well, that stemmed from the yellow fever epidemic that completely reset Memphis, changed the composure of the population. But during
because it was African Americans that stayed behind and made the city work while it was going to hell.
Black people saved the city. It was thought for a time that Memphis would be abandoned and cease to exist because of this plague. Well, black people stayed. They couldn't afford to leave, but they stayed. They enjoyed a certain enjoyed is not a great verb. They had a certain level of immunity to the fever, at least relative to white people. They did not perish at quite the same catastrophic rate as white people did. So they took control. They formed militias and protected property from being looted. They delivered aid in the form of food and medicine. I mean, they kept everything from collapsing during this time when a lot of people suspected that it might be over. Additionally, there were a few prominent businessmen associated with the city that did not want to see it go away. And so it was thought to start up some recovery bonds in which people could invest their cash in the recovery of the city of Memphis. And as legend has it, the very first one of these bonds purchased was by Robert Church, the African-American leader, for a sum of $1,000. And so coming out of that fever period, you have a heroic savior figure in church. First of all, you have a majority black population because so many white people fled and died. But you also have a sense of responsibility. And I think that the white leadership that stayed behind and was key in revitalizing the city, one, legitimately appreciated that. Two, was politically pragmatic enough to know, well, and let me say something else that made Memphis extraordinary throughout this time period. The black vote remained constant. And so if you wanted power in 1880s Memphis, that was your majority constituency right there. That's who you had to serve. And so getting back a little bit to Ida B. Wells, because the fever was so instrumental in her life. She was raised in Holly Springs, Mississippi, what, 80 miles away or so? And the fever killed off much of her family. So she brought her surviving siblings up to Memphis. Well, the world that she saw in Memphis was so drastically different from what she had been raised in Mississippi. She was born in slavery. Well, here she saw a bipartisan, biracial political coalition that was in charge of everything. There was a black council person, a couple of African-American county attorneys, black wharf master, who was also one of the key political strategists, Robert Church, tons of businesses along Beale Street. I mean, it was, like I said, this alternate universe. But that had to do partially with white attitudes, whether it's altruism or pragmatism, whatever. I mean, the result, I think, was the same, which was extraordinary opportunity here for African-American citizens for a while. Now, one of the great leaders during this time was a man named Pappy Hatton. He's a very colorful character who was the president of Memphis.
Is the proto-Bras Crump.
Yes, I think so in many ways, right. Because, one, he benefited greatly from vice. He recognized that the brothels and the saloons and the gambling halls were always good business. They were recession-proof, and so they kept the money flowing in while he was trying to do very basic repairs on the city, you know, to improve its sewer system, improve the sidewalks and the streets, all these things that had been to blame for the yellow fever in the eyes of the people then. But he was also very much a liberal when it came to race issues, and he was a victim of his own success. He was in charge throughout the 1880s. By the early 1890s, he had succeeded in rebuilding and largely repopulating the city. Well, he repopulated it with people from Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, places where Reconstruction really had ended back in 1877. It didn't end in Memphis. You know, that era of black political power that started with Reconstruction continued. And so I think people came from these places and saw the same things Ida B. Wells did, but looked at it very differently. And so Pappy Hatton was ousted from power. He really did remain true to, I think, the basic principles of post-fever Memphis, which is to serve that black constituency and partner with black office holders.
But it was amazing statistic to see that was it the 1920 election that 100,000 African Americans voted in the presidential election that year.
It was about 160,000 in the state of Tennessee. But that allowed, and this is jumping ahead to 1920, to another, I think, very unusual era just in the prominence of black power. But 1920 election, it was the first time since, I believe, the end of Reconstruction in 1877, about 50 years, that any of the former Confederate states had gone for the Republican Party. That would be the equivalent today of a state like Mississippi or Alabama going to the Democratic Party. Just a complete shock. Just hadn't happened. There was no precedent for it. And the roots of that extraordinary movement also were on Beale Street.
Not being a native Memphian, I didn't know much about the history of E.H. Crump. And to find out that he was actually bounced from office by the state for not following state laws against prostitution and prohibition.
Prohibition, right. Yeah. No, that surprised me too. But that was a real key turning point in Crump's life. So been mayor for about 6 years, went through all of this legal turmoil with the state based on vice, Crump's support of it. It led to him resigning from office, I believe, while there was an ouster suit brought against him. So it was sort of like the Nixon impeachment, you know, it was just a matter of time. Though technically he resigned rather than being ousted, but it was under severe pressure. But it led Crump to rethink how best to maintain power. And he realized that it was not in elected office, because then you were subject to the approval of the voters, whatever legal intervention the state or the federal authorities might bring to certain circumstances. So he realized he was better off running things behind the scenes. And so that low moment in his early career really helped to create one of the great political masterminds of the 20th century.
And some even said that the extent of his machine and his amount of power surpassed that even of Boss Tweed of Tammany Hall.
Well, he was in power for longer than Tweed was at Tammany Hall. He had complete control of – this developed over time. But I would say by – well, certainly by 1932, when you had a Democrat win the White House for the first time in a while, he had everything locked up from the city offices, the county offices, the state legislature. U.S. Senator was very friendly to him. Of course, the U.S. Congress people from Memphis's district, electoral votes for the Democratic Party in presidential elections locked up. A lot of influence in the Democratic National Convention as well. He legendarily, at least, helped to get the Huey Long delegation sat in the 1932 convention, which nominated FDR. I mean, we think about FDR as being, you know, this unstoppable force of nature, but, you know, like any other unknown candidate before he becomes famous and powerful, he needed help. And so he worked these various Southern boss constituencies to his advantage.
Now, one of the political organizations that I hadn't heard of before was the Lincoln League.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of a shadow Crump organization, and in fact, a shadow of the Crump organization. In fact, I think the Lincoln League really helped the Crump machine to get going during that period after Crump was ousted from the mayor's office. So Crump resigned in February 1916. I believe the Lincoln League geared up for the fall 1916. Elections. It was a completely black-run organization, the key figure being Robert Church Jr., son of the original Beale Street kingpin. Church Jr., look, this is, you know, almost 50 years before the Voting Rights Act passed, and Church Jr. led what I think is probably the most ambitious and successful registration drive of black voters in the South during that period, I mean, before the civil rights movement. It was remarkable. It began locally with basic voter education. This is how you do it. Voter registration drives. This is what you have to do. I mean, very basic training. But it was interesting. He set up the Lincoln League on a neighborhood and precinct type of a level. That is, he had people on every block in every black neighborhood who were affiliated with his organization, who could talk to people about it, get people interested in it, to drum up support, basically. But it was a very well-organized machine, and it went from, you know, African-American neighborhoods here essentially all the way up to the White House. Church became a prime political organizer in a number of different states. As we said earlier, he won the state of Tennessee for the Republican Party in 1920. That was after, by the way, he was very unceremoniously dumped from the delegation that would nominate. But he still got out there and organized black voters in Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, I believe, definitely in Maryland. So he had a real far-reaching influence. Extraordinary time, the 1920s in Memphis. You had the most powerful African-American politician in the country, and you had this white Democratic machine on the rise. And for a time, the two made very unusual allies. The Crump machine, as it was rising from the ashes in 1916, needed votes, needed political organization. The whole saloonocracy that had helped Crump get into office in the first place was done away with. Prohibition.
And so African Americans had identified with the Republican Party because it's the party
right.
of Lincoln who had
yes.
signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And it wasn't until a group of Republicans known as the Lily Whites kind of
yep.
drove them into the arms of the Democratic Party.
It was an ongoing struggle. There was a segment of the Republican Party, even when Robert Church Jr. was at his most powerful and influential, who believed that black people had no place in it whatsoever, had no place in politics. Those were the Lily Whites. They didn't care that he was an effective leader, that he was getting their presidential candidates elected and winning their state, you know, for the first time. He was black, and that was no good. For Mr. Church, it was a struggle on every level, from the county level. Memphis is in Shelby County, so it was always a struggle between his black group and the Lily Whites in Shelby County in order to get recognized to go to the state convention, the state level. It was always a battle there against the state Lily Whites, you know, to gain the recognition, official recognition of the party. And then when he made it to the national conventions, it was always a struggle there. So this Lily White element battled church for his entire career. And he battled them and beat them for many, many years. Eventually, you know, that changed, and the whole racial identity of the political parties over time reversed. It was a pretty gradual process, but the Lily Whites had a lot to do with it.
It's because of this confrontation at the 1920 convention when it's pointed out that he has his hands in unsavory business, and there's a crackdown coming to Memphis too, and he has to divest himself of the bordellos over on Gayoso. That kind of sets in motion the slow decline of the empire.
Yes, it does. It's such an interesting, surprising twist once again. Another key element to put in play in 1920, the women's vote, which was going to be a factor in national politics.
Brand new.
For the first time, thanks to Memphis. Memphis congressman was, I believe, the key vote for ratification in order to get that amendment in time for the 1920 presidential election. So Mr. Church recognized that the source of his wealth and power was also a tremendous liability. And he realized that he could not be both a brothel owner and a political leader in this new era in which women were voting. And so he turned all of the church family brothels, the cornerstone of his family's wealth, and I think a cornerstone of this Beale Street civilization, into residential properties. They were a lot less lucrative. He was not able to maintain his financial independence, which was a real source of his strength during his most powerful years.
Well, Preston, I want to thank you so much for stopping by. And we could have talked for 2 hours about this book, but I want to appreciate you sharing your research and insights into Beale Street's historical dimensions.
Thank you.
Preston Lauterbach is the author of Beale Street Dynasty, Sex, Song, and the Struggle for the Soul of Memphis, which is published by W.W. Norton. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.